When Elena was growing up, she kept a diary. A very long diary.
This is from ninth grade, page 954.
In it, Elena wrote about her life, her friends, her family, and her teachers.
At lunch, I was offering fries to my friends, and stupid Mr. Grattan, a teacher, stole some of my fries. Then he came back, took more, and dipped them in gravy. I complained by email to the principal. I was so offended. A basic stranger steals your fries? What's this world becoming?
Indeed, what is this world becoming? That's Elena reading from her ninth grade diary, and this is Grown-Ups Read Things They Wrote as Kids. I'm Dan Meisner. Each week on the show, we invite Canadians to share their childhood and teenage writing, their diaries, their poetry, short stories, and their tales of French fry impropriety. This week, recorded live at the Rocket Room in St. John's, Newfoundland, we have sibling rivalry, backhanded compliments, and werewolves. This stuff is cute. It is funny. But it also has a lot to teach us about who we are and who we were. So think about the stuff that you wrote when you were a kid, the stuff you might have tucked away in a box in the closet. And stick around. Life is like a box of chocolates, and love is a battlefield. At some point in school, most of us learn the concepts of simile and metaphor, figures of speech that compare one thing to another. Jason learned about similes and metaphors in grade 5, and armed with these brand new literary devices, he wrote a collection of poems, one for each person in his class. Some of them are cute. Others, as you'll hear, are passive-aggressive.
Friends, it's titled. January 15th, 1992. Matthew is one of a kind. He's always there when you need him most. We are like a pair of shoes, the same but different. Chris is like homework. Sometimes you think there's no use for it, but there is. Greg is always different, like a store, always standing tall and strong and always changing inside. First he was a bully, then girl crazy. Now a fun guy and my friend. Amy is like a telephone. When you pick it up, there's always someone there. That's not necessarily true with a phone. Always there when you pick it up, and there's someone to talk to. And a person to listen. They can also talk back if you need it. Christine is like a box of toys. It may be hard to open, but when it's opened, it's worth it, because there are all kinds of things inside. Feelings, a human, and a great person. What kind of toy box did I have? Brian is like a computer. He knows so much, but so little. I mean, it's always getting better and more advanced. Rebecca is like a shoe, usually just kicked around, but it's always good to have. Now, Rebecca was bullied, not by me, but she was bullied. I think that's where that's coming from. Michael is like a box. Always it can be filled with secrets and things, and yet can be so empty. Ryan is like a punching bag and punching gloves. They can be used separately, but are better together. The gloves, evil. The bag, good. And finally, Mrs. B is like a house. You can always change a room or two, but it'll always be a good old house. So, some insight to my relations as a little person. Thank you.
I've been hosting live Grown Ups Read Things They Wrote as Kids events for years now, and one subject that keeps coming up show after show is siblings. And as anyone who grew up with brothers and sisters knows, you cannot have siblings without sibling rivalry. Take Murray.
So this is the only diary I ever did in my entire life, and as you can see, it's a beautiful Babysitter's Club journal with "I hate Sheena" written down the side. March 7th, 1994. Why me? I'm always the one getting in trouble. Is it my fault I'm going into adolescence? There's one thing I know about this family, and that's that I am not Mom's favorite. Sheena doesn't like me. The boys are on Sheena's side. I'm no one's favorite. I'm rejected. I bet they wouldn't care if I did suicide. I'm crying as I write this. I wish I were treated more nicely among my siblings and parents. I'm probably just thinking everything's bad, even though they aren't. I can't help it. No one really likes me. Here's what they say about Sheena. Cute, funny, smart. Liam, cute, smart. Philip, amazing, smart. Murray, smart. Well, you can see I'm not a very happy girl. Bye for now. March 8th, 1994. Did I forget to tell you that I'm in Grandma's house? Well, all that stuff I said wasn't true. They like me, they just get mad at me. I also get mad at them. I've got to control my temper. It is true, I don't get along with my sister that much. Well, I better go now. Murray Egan. P.S. I love animals and God and me and singing and acting and my family and no boys, well, maybe a few, and flying.
Murray, ladies and gentlemen.
So, how does Murray get along with her brothers and sister today? I followed up, and I am pleased to report they're getting along fine. Though, Murray told me by email that Sheena is, quote, still winning the sister war. 2 years younger, PhD in biomedical ethics, married to a doctor living in Europe and teaching a course at an Ivy League university next year. The horrible thing, she adds, is that she's also a really nice person. Of course, the relationships we have with our siblings change as we get older. Some of us grow closer. Others grow apart. It can be a lot of fun to look back at the things that we wrote about our brothers and sisters, or to go through old photos and laugh at our hair or our clothes. I have a photo of me and my sister, Laura. It's Halloween. We're standing in our living room. We are all dressed up, and we are ready to trick or treat. She's cute. I'm cute. It's a good memory. I think it's important to remember our younger days, but it's not always easy. Here's Sam.
January 5th, 05, I was 12. This poem is dedicated to my sister Sarah, who has passed away. I will never see your eyes. I will never see your nose. I will never get to feel your small, cold, wiggly toes. I will never kiss your cheek. I will never take a peek at someone I don't know. I will never tell you stories. I will never hold your hand. I will never help you walk in the hot, hot sand. I will never see you grow up. I will never push you on the swing. I will never see your boyfriend give you a wedding ring. I will never see you smiling. I will never hear you talk. I will never take you to the store or go for a long walk. I will never see or hear you for as long as I'm alive. But when I go to heaven, I will never leave your side. Thank you.
Well, I've actually never read it out loud. I had written it for a school project. It was grade six. They had asked you to write a poem, so I did. I made my mom cry for a couple of days. And yeah, it's currently on the same piece of paper that it's always been written on, and I just keep it safe. Sharing it with a bunch of people who most of them I don't know for the first time was pretty terrifying. And then trying not to cry in front of a bunch of people that I don't know was also really hard, but I had dedicated it to my sister, and that's what it's for. Read it and keep her memory alive. My entire family and I, we do keep it in memory, because what's the point of forgetting it? It's a part of your life. If you don't accept it, you'll never move on from it. And it's not like, and moving on is probably the wrong phrase. We don't move on from her death. We celebrate her life. You celebrate those few precious moments we had with her. And keeping this and just keeping is keeping her memory alive.
This is Grown-Ups Read Things They Wrote as Kids. I'm Dan Meisner. Each week on our show, we invite Canadians to share their childhood and teenage writing. Today's show was recorded live at the Rocket Room in St. John's, Newfoundland. Our next reader, Trudy, was an ambitious 7-year-old. She was not satisfied with writing a single short story, so she created Stories About Jane, her first trilogy of novels.
Okay, it's my first and also my last trilogy. The trilogy begins, Jane was 8 years old. She, though not Chinese, lived in China. Which ended up causing me a lot of trouble, as I knew nothing about China, and I eventually had to move her back to Canada. The first two chapters are taken up entirely with Jane learning her letters and numbers, which of course is gripping. I finally introduce some conflict in the third chapter, Jane's illness. Jane became sick, so sick that she must lie on her bed all day. She put up with this last thing with a struggle, for her bed was only a few boards with some prickly strips of hay on it. A night's rest was enough. Finally, they got her onto it. Jane was sick. Yes, she was very sick. Usually a small piece of corn and bread and a drop of water was not half enough for her breakfast. Now it was enough for the whole day. Her family did not believe in the Chinese doctors. And she needed one. The doctor that they wanted to see, well, to get to his place and back, it would take a week to get each way. When they got there, he looked Jane over. "She'll get better," he said. The family believed him. Jane would get better. But when? And how? And I clearly had the idea of ending, that is the chapter end, and I love that it ends on a cliffhanger, but the next chapter begins, the doctor was right. Jane did get better. I'll skip ahead to the final volume of the trilogy, in which Jane is 19 years old and facing the difficult decision of whom to marry. She is dating a young man named Johan, and he asks her to marry him. Jane took a whole year to make up her mind. And after she made up her mind not to marry Johan, he fell in love with another young lady about 6 years older than Jane. Johan clearly likes experience. Having finished school at 19, she was helping Mama prepare dinner one afternoon. Despite having been raised by fairly progressive feminist parents, it didn't occur to me that there was anything else Jane might want to do at 19 other than help Mama prepare dinner and run mentally through a list of every young man she knew to see who she could marry. She began to think again. Ken, book 2, chapter 6, in brackets, was her cousin, so not him. So it's good that I've ruled out incest. "That's it, Jimmy Jones," she yelled, and gave a thudding jump. Crash, crack, went the dish in her hand. Glad to find it wasn't her great-great-great-great-grandmother's hand-me-down plate with the blue and yellow flowers on it, Jane picked up the pieces, thinking, I can't just say him and marry him. Jim's got to love me. She needn't have worried about that. A day later, Jimmy Jones asked her to marry him. Conveniently. Of course, she had her mind made up. A few days later, Janie Heine, which apparently was her name, became Mrs. J. Jones. At 8 o'clock on the wedding night, after the wedding was over and the bride and groom walked to the Jones home where they were to live till they found a place of their own, Jane whispered to her new husband, this truly was, oh, happy day. And even softer, as the sky grew blacker and the stars more bright, came Jim's simple reply, and the only line of dialogue he gets in this trilogy, yes.
Trudy wasn't the only reader at our St. John's show to bring some short fiction to the stage. Elling brought along one of his childhood stories entitled Turning into a Werewolf. Except, I'm not really doing that title justice, because in the original copy, Turning into a Werewolf is written entirely in capital letters and is followed by five. That's right, five exclamation points. Luckily for us, Elling figured out a way to read all caps on stage.
So I'm gonna go like this. I'm gonna go like this for the all caps parts. Turning into a werewolf. On a full moon Halloween night in the hospital, a bottle of blood was taken and replaced with another bottle of red liquid as a Halloween joke. Afterwards. Oh, Edmonds has fainted, said one of the people at the Halloween party. We'd better bring him to the hospital, said another. I'll phone the ambulance, Edmonds' dad said, helpfully. With the telephone receiver in his hand, he phoned the hospital. Ed was still on the ground when the ambulance bed and workers came rushing through the door, picked him up onto the bed, rushed him out the door, and put him in the ambulance. Actually, abulance. He needs blood, said the doctor when Ed finally woke up. The doctor took the red liquid from the shelf, put the needle in Ed's arm, and... Ouch. Said Edmonds as the doctor took the needle out of Ed's arm. The doctor turned around to talk to Ed's father when hair started to grow out of Ed's body. But no one noticed except Ed, and he wanted it to stop. But it didn't. It just kept on growing more and more hair. All of a sudden, Ed, now the werewolf, got up and jumped out the door, got in the elevator, ripped the siding rails and bottoms off of it. How went the werewolf? And ran into the hall and started tearing down the wall. He opened the door marked exit, ran down the stairs, and out the exit. How, he cried again. Just then, he saw another small werewolf walking along the sidewalk with a bag in his hand. So the werewolf joined in with him. Then he saw lots of monsters around him all stopping at the different houses. He was confused, so he howled. How? That's how it's written. I can't do... Oh! I suppose that's how it's supposed to be done. Everyone looked at him and stopped doing what they were doing and either ran or locked their doors and windows. Then the werewolf started to go towards Ed's house. The werewolf's house. When he got there, he hopped on the roof, jumped down the chimney, and ran to Ed's bed. Then, he got in.
Later!
Ed woke up and said, Phew, glad it was only a dream. Or was it? And Ed got up and took off his sooty clothes. The end.
Yes, that is our St. John's audience howling like werewolves in approval. If you want to see Elling's original Turning Into a Werewolf story, we have a scanned copy of it at our website, grownupsreadthingstheywroteaskids.com. That's grownupsreadthingstheywroteaskids.com. Kids write all kinds of stories. Elling wrote about werewolves. Trudy, she wrote about a fictional girl named Jane. But sometimes, even when it's presented as fiction, kids are writing stories about themselves. Our next reader, Nu, was born and raised in Vietnam. As a kid, she wanted to travel. She wanted to explore the world. But she couldn't. To travel, you need money, and Nu didn't have any. But when she was 15, Nu won a competition and some prize money. So she packed her bags and traveled to Canada on an exchange program. There, she stayed with a Canadian couple who she had never met, but who took her in and treated her like their own daughter. Here's Nu reading her story, Tale of a Notebook, which describes her journey in coming to Canada.
I wrote this story a little less than a year after I came to Canada, so my English was not that great. So a long time ago, in an innumerable and extensive forest of a tropical country somewhere in Asia, I was born in a rain of happiness and tears of my family. I was a tree. Day by day, I grew up like every creature on this planet Earth. My hands started to grow longer, so did my legs. I was taller and taller. The more I grew up, the more things I saw around me. My family taught me how to love, to live, and about humans. The knowledge I had learned made me so curious about the world around me. I always wanted to go to travel further, not only in the small forest, which was thought to be gigantic when I was just a little tree. However, my legs grew deeper in the ground, making me not able to go anywhere. My life since that day turned to be more unhappy. Instead of trying to go further away, hopelessly, I stay there and try to make myself look like a great tree so that someday some human might want to take me with them if they ever come to this forest. Whatever will be, will be. One morning, I suddenly woke up by a very loud and bothering sound from some kind of equipment I had never seen before in my tree life. They were humans. They looked different from me, my family, and every creature that I had ever seen in this forest. A few minutes after, a huge, sharp, and strong things controlled by human inside walked towards me and cut my legs away. I fell down in an effort of my family trying to hold me back up with their branches. Some of my branches were broken, and I was in a state of happiness, fear, and great pain. I was happy that I finally got to do what I wanted, going out of this forest and seeing this beautiful world around me, but I feared to be away from my family, to be without them. What would I do without them? In the next paragraphs, I describe how I woke up in a factory and was made into a notebook. I am now a tiny white thing that humans call notebook. I'm so small and so tiny. However, I seem to like how I look now. The outside of me was covered with a shining golden hardback decorated with different sophisticated patterns on both sides. The inside of me included hundreds of pages. My pages were white and soft. They have light horizontal green lines on the surface, and they smell very good, I would say. Day by day, I sat on the shelf waiting for somebody to buy me. While I was lamenting on the shelf, I noticed a small little girl coming to the shelf which I was lying on, and not long after that, I was bought from the store. My life once became more promising to me. I said goodbye to the store and a few poor friends who were still lying there waiting for somebody to pick them up. I hope they find a good home. I now have an owner, and my owner seemed to like me a lot. She put me among her favorite books and gave me a title, Little Diary. I actually like my new life here, being with my me little owner. I have a sincere respect for her. She's keeping me safe and clean. She takes me places and treats me like a true friend. She tells me every single story and everything she has spent, and even her feelings every day. I no longer miss my family as much as I used to, and I'm no longer feeling lonely and unprotected. It has been a year since the day she took me out of that store. 365 pages have been filled, and there's a lot more pages are not written on yet. I know there's a lot more still waiting for me in the future. I'm here to try to make my dreams come true. I'm too young to give up anything, and I will never do, because I'm alive for this life and because I'm my parents' child.
I totally forgot about it until about a few months ago when I moved out of my old apartment, and my dad came to my Canadian dad. He came to help me out, and he found this. And growing up in a culture where you don't really express your feelings a lot, I don't think I ever told him that I, you know, like that's how I felt about them at all. So he found that, and he read it, and he kept it. When my dad found it, I was kind of going through a hard period of my life. So to see the younger me having so much passion for life and the spirit of not giving up and just want to explore the world was a push for me at the time. And when I looked back, I'm like, wow, I mean, if the young me had that much strength and courage, that the current me could do the same thing. I guess sometimes, you know, you live life and you kind of forget what, because things happen and you become more jaded, you become discouraged from all the negativities, and you forget who you were. So to look back at that, and it's like a nice reminder of who you used to be and who you wanted to be.
That's Grown-Ups Read Things They Wrote as Kids for this week. Our show was recorded live at the Rocket Room in St. John's, Newfoundland, and produced by Allison Broverman and me, Dan Meisner. Thanks this week to recording engineer Terry Windsor. Our music is by Lullatone. You can listen to this and every other episode of our show at the website, cbc.ca/grownups. That's also where you can subscribe to our totally free weekly podcast. You know, here at Grown-Ups Read Things They Wrote as Kids, we are always on the lookout for a new catchphrase, something that we can use to explain the show to people who haven't heard it yet. And I think this week, we may have a new catchphrase. Let's give this a shot. Grown-Ups Read Things They Wrote as Kids.
Sometimes you think there's no use for it, but there is.
I'm Dan Meisner. Thanks for listening.